makes it a pretty short step for them to now be much more intimately involved in internal security. So you could say almost the stage has been set for them to get involved in internal security matters with the drug war. But now with this 9/11 event, truly a legitimate threat, and I would argue that the drug war wasn't a legitimate threat, but with the 9/11 event, truly a legitimate threat, it's just a small step now to get the military very involved in internal security matters.
In response to the September 11th terrorist attacks on Washington and New York City, the Defense Department created a Homeland Command for domestic military operations. While the Pentagon insists that any operations conducted by this command will be under the control of civilian law enforcement, critics warn that by involving the military more intimately in internal affairs, the United States may be abandoning its traditional values of civil-military separation.
When William Cohen was Secretary of Defense, he said at one point an extraordinary thing. He said the Americans were going to have to get used to choosing between security and their civil liberties. That, I thought, was sort of a scary choice for a country that had been started by someone saying, give me liberty or give me death. And I don't think it is decent or acceptable behavior for a public official to tell you that your choice is between your civil liberties and your security. And this, I think, is a proper reaction to somebody like that. But unfortunately, you see, people just sort of, it just sort of goes out over the airwaves and just becomes part of our consciousness. The next thing we know, we start to believe it.
Of a recent documentary film by Matt Ehling, Urban Warrior, on the militarization of policing in America. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or W201CD Ithaca Community Radio. Next, we continue with a panel discussion with several of the people interviewed in the film that followed a recent screening of Urban Warrior in New York City.
Okay, I'm just going to launch right into it.
A lot of this, to the people on the panel, people who have been following this, is sort of like paramilitary policing 101. There's a lot more information that we have that we'd like to get out to people. You know, when you look at a lot of this stuff, it's something that looks fairly horrifying to people. And the reason we're doing this is not because we're trying to horrify people, but, you know, like, well, it's Alcoholic Anonymous. And the first step is to just admit there's a problem. Then you begin getting it cured. Things that I was describing before the thing began, like the pilot program that took place in Oregon that had the National Guard accompanying police. Through the use of alternative media and getting it out to the public, we were able to kill that program. Stop it dead in its tracks. Now, the way that a lot of these policies go out on a national level to through the government is very similar to the way that the corporations will market policies, test market policies. You know, for example, if anyone's read the book Megatrends, it outlines that there's little areas that are out of the way where they try pilot projects, and you'll see things that are on the shelves for these corporations that are not on the shelves anywhere else. Same thing with policies. That's why, like, when they were starting using the National Guard and the war on drugs, they started in very out-of-the-way places, like Hawaii. Then they moved that to places like Oregon, Northern California, where you don't have a lot of population. You can try it out without a lot of people hearing about it. And by killing these programs in a very infantile stage, we really kept them from expanding on a much larger level. And I think we can do the same thing here with a lot of what's going on. I think, and I'm going to keep my marks fairly brief, because we do have a lot of things, and we do want to take questions from the audience. I think we do have to tie what is going on here with September 11th and the whole buildup that we've seen go on in the wake of September 11th. Here's something that crystallized how serious our government is about taking care of terrorism and combating terrorism. I was sitting in on a hearing about a month ago on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and the transportation of waste. Now, in the mid-90s, I think 97, 98, 96, they were coming up with these plans to transport all of the nuclear waste in the country to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Those plans involved taking 70,000 trucks, driving them all through this country, taking them finally to the Columbia River Gorge, one of the worst highways, one of the worst stretches of road in this country, and then dumping it all in one place. Now, that was all written before September 11th. So when I was sitting in on this public hearing, I asked the people who were doing this, what changes have you brought about as a result of September 11th? I know if I go like through the airports, I get every stop I go, I get, you know, they go over me with 1950s era technology. What changes have been brought about as a result of September 11th with transporting this nuclear waste? None. I asked them point blank. You're saying none? None. That's how serious these people are. They're not. It's not about taking care of terrorism. A lot of this has a lot of economic reasons that we're seeing this. The only thing that got us out of the Depression, World War II. The only thing that kept the economy going after World War II, the Cold War. What happens at the end of the Cold War? You end up finding other ways that we can look at a military economy. So you have this huge buildup of things like the prison industrial complex, to the point where we now have more people in prison than any civilized nation in the history of this planet. And you have things like the war on drugs and the war on crime, but you've also had things like the war on terrorism. And when you start looking at it, well, I think the thing to bear in mind about almost every war that this country has been in is that our government has lied to people. Is that something that shocks most of the people in this audience? Our government lies to you. Does that shock you? We can look at things like how we got into the Spanish-American War, sinking of the Maine. We can look at things like the way that we got into World War I, the sinking of the Lusitania, all of which turned to be things that our government was lying, fabricating incidents, things like the Gulf of Tonkin, a completely fabricated incident for the Vietnam War. What I thought of immediately when I saw the World Trade Center go down and what struck me that same day was the Reichstag. Anyone here familiar with the Reichstag? Can I see by show of hands? What is that like? About a third or fourth of the people. Reichstag was a building, a government building, at the time that the Nazis were starting to come into power, that was blown up in a very public way and was blamed up by the Nazis on their opponents and was used as a complete pretext, as a tool, as a way for the Nazis to just grab complete power. And, of course, what it turned out historically was that the Nazis had, in fact, blown the building up themselves. First military invasion that was supposedly inflicted upon the Nazis in the town of Leipzig was actually turned out to be for the pretext for the Nazis declaring war on Poland, in the town of Leipzig. What, in fact, had happened was that the Nazis had dressed up a bunch of Polish prisoners in army uniform, marched them across the border, shot them up, and then said that we are being invaded, so we have to invade Poland. Now, of course, if you read books like, start studying like how our own National Security Agency was founded, you know, we didn't just inherit people like Wernher von Braun. The people who had the best intelligence on the Soviet Union was the Nazis. So they formed the backbone for groups like our own CIA and NSA. Not a big secret. And when you look at the way that our government has gone after some of our own activists, like the group of the Arizona Five, the Earth First, for example, they had a group of activists who, what the FBI did, and this is all available through court documents, they decided who was the most vulnerable person in this group. A woman by the name of Peg Millett, found out what her ideal man looked like, had someone by that profile join the group, and then begin encouraging everyone there to do these little more and more outrageous actions, ending with it, which no one was into doing, by the way, ending with them tearing down a power line. How did they tear down a power line? Well, they said, you know, guy, we're not really into doing this. Well, he says, you know, well, I'll buy you the materials, and I'll show you how to do it, and I'll even drive you out to the site, which he did. So they all go out to the site, and flood lights go on. That's the way our government operates. One other book, I'm not sure they're carrying it in the back. Take a look at Bamford's new book on the founding of the National Security Council, and take a look at the 10 pages or so on what happened with Cuba in the 1960s. As one of the things that's come out through recently declassified documents is that our government was planning to fabricate, there were a large portion of our government that was planning to fabricate a war with Cuba that involved doing things like blowing up U.S. ships, setting up bombs in the U.S., across the U.S. If one of our Apollo ships had gone up, we were going to blame that on the Cubans. That had been, in fact, approved by every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and it was only stopped because you had someone by the name of Robert McNamara who was able to stop it. I don't see anyone in Bush's administration playing the role of Robert McNamara now, so if they're planning something like this 40 years later, they may just happen to go through with it. There are a lot of other reasons we can go into and things that we're looking at in terms of like how they're going to even take this even steps further, and this is a result of a lot of plans, and you have some of the wealthiest people on the planet that have been planning this for a substantial period of time. We can go into that a little bit more in detail. But since we are kind of limited on time, and we did start this a little late, go to the other panelists, and then we can kind of move on to that in our question and answer period. So thank you.
My name is Frank Morales. I write for Covert Action Quarterly magazine, particularly focusing on the role of the Pentagon in its domestic so-called operations other than war, which is the doctrinal head under which the Pentagon has inserted itself into domestic law enforcement, called OOTW, Operations Other Than War. It's a really booming sector of the Pentagon these days, particularly with the whole Homeland Defense apparatus. I would just have to say a few things about Homeland Security. Much of this is written up, for those who are interested, in a book that I just got published called Police State America, which has separate chapters on the non-lethal warfare stuff, civil disturbance planning on the part of the Pentagon, through Operation Garden Plot, which is the standalone DOD contingency plan for suppressing protests in the U.S., and some other issues around the militarization of the police, some of the latest gadgets, electromagnetic pulse weapons to disperse crowds and this kind of thing. And I think around the Homeland Defense, just historically, and then we can ask the question, well, why is this militarization of the police taking place? Because I think that's kind of an obvious question, right? Why are they doing this? But in any case, Homeland Defense euphemism began to be circulated within the Pentagon as early as 94-95, at which time the notion of Homeland Defense was linked to, yes, both anti-terrorist rhetoric and plans and so forth, but was very clearly linked to protest. As you know, mid-90s, right up through Seattle and beyond, a lot of people were in the streets. It was at this time that the notion of Homeland Defense emerged within the Pentagon. And I think it's important to recognize that in answer to why this militarization, from my perspective, it's part of an overall counterinsurgency. It's part of an apparatus that's derived from corporate interlocks, outfits like the Center for Strategic and International Affairs Studies, the Council on Foreign Relations, and other corporate think tanks that interlock with military personnel. You see a number of someone's on the Joint Chiefs one week, and then there's suddenly a fellow at organizations like CSIS. And between CSIS and the Council on Foreign Relations, these are the talking heads you see on the TV all the time. These individuals who've authored numerous studies on everything from non-lethal warfare to this whole question of the militarization of the police to repealing of the Posse Comitatus Act, which I'll get to in a minute, they represent a politics that has to do with, you know, their own agenda, which obviously is to seize large chunks of the globe, particularly where there are resources that they covet. And that requires, that global militarism, if you will, requires a dialectical an approach at home in order to preemptively, suppress. And that's the whole notion of proactive and preemption in terms of this notion of counterinsurgency, which is about undermining the insurgency of the people. It's a Central Intelligence Agency term, counterinsurgency. These corporate military link-ups through these entities and what's happening at the Pentagon these days is a full-blown, hands-on approach on the part of the transnational corporations to suppressing resistance to their global agenda. I don't want to oversimplify it, but I think if we see the militarization of the police and other such maneuvers, the Homeland Defense, the Patriot Act, and other things, as though they exist in some abstract realm, we're missing the point. The war against terrorism may in fact be about asymmetric threats, the David and Goliath thing, but a lot of it has to do with being a war against dissent, a war against us. And it's pretty obvious now that the issue of, you know, the military and the police and delineation between the two is really a moot point. The NYPD has hired Mr. Cohen to handle counterintelligence and intelligence gathering here as part of the NYPD's former head of special operations of the Central Intelligence Agency. Mr. Labuti, who's been hired to handle some other aspect of Homeland Defense in New York City here, is former head of NATO and affiliated with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This symbiosis between the military and the police at this point has become so threatening, from my perspective, to the normal functioning of democratic civil liberties and some democratic space within which to resist. But I think now we really have to get clear on what we're up against here and how to go about and fight it. The Posse Comitatus Act, which has been mentioned over and over again, is a two-sentence criminal statute. It says something like, whoever uses part of the military as a Posse Comitatus, as a law enforcement entity, will be fined not more than $10,000 and imprisoned for 10 years. Boom. That's it. It's a criminal statute, but it's that and the tradition of the separation between the military and the police has for, many years now, functioned as a kind of a break on the military becoming the police. Through the exceptions in the drug war and others, and most recently this past July, the New York Times here, wider military role in U.S. is urged. And they're talking, very overtly now. The Bush administration has directed lawyers in the Departments of Justice and Defense to review the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 and any other laws that sharply restrict the military's ability to participate in domestic law enforcement. And as I said, a lot of this domestic law enforcement is a euphemism for dealing with protest. This is essentially what we're dealing with here. The homeland, the security apparatus, which is currently being kicked into gear, the House of Representatives passed a bill, it's 5005, which creates this Office of Homeland Security, within which the law itself further waters down this distinction between the military and the police. I think it's Section 766, which notes that this Act shall not limit the military's ability to wage war, while at the same time shall not restrict its ability to deal with law, assist law enforcement in its capacity. It's a convoluted thing, but basically is moving towards this repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act. This review that the Bush people have ordered of the Posse Comitatus Act is due out the end of this month, concurrent with the standing up, as they say in the military, of the Northern Command. This is a command of the Pentagon, which is focused specifically on Homeland Defense, in other words, on the military application to domestic law enforcement. It's headed out by this General Eberhardt, and gets officially going on October 1st, which is, it will dovetail nicely for them if the Posse Comitatus Act can be repealed. But more specifically, is to make noise around, we cannot allow the Posse Comitatus Act, this 1878 statute, which prohibits the military from being involved in domestic law enforcement, slash pro-civil disturbance suppression. We can't let them repeal this or water it down. And this is, there's not a lot of people that are aware that this is taking place right now, so we need to contact people and let them know. And the other thing is that we need to, and then I want to open it up, get on to the next person here. I could go into detail and, put you all to sleep, but it's all in the book. And if you have an email or something like that, you can slip it to me and I'll send you everything I've got, because that's what it's about for me, is getting out the information. There are areas of protest, for instance, at the University of Pennsylvania, where there is a thing called the Institute for Non-Lethal Technologies. This is in the piece that I wrote. Institute for Non-Lethal. It's the only place within the country. It's one of these public-private things, a $40 million U.S. Marine grant to the University of Pennsylvania to set up this Institute for Non-Lethal Technologies. At this place, they have created what they call a health effects advisory panel. This panel calibrates degrees of suffering that, they have what is called a virtual human, which tests the depth that a rubber bullet enters the skin. You know what I mean? It calibrates the degrees to which certain chemicals affect the body. It's the DOD's health advisory panel, and it deals with non-lethal weapons that are being used to target protests. We can shut that down at the University of Pennsylvania. We can expose it. We can bring to light what exactly is going on in this place. They're field testing now an electromagnetic pulse weapon, which will heat skin from 200 feet away to 130 degrees. They're field testing this now. And an electromagnetic weapon also, because the DOD, as Paul mentioned, this whole thing about non-lethal weapons, the DOD's own directive around non-lethal weapons, because, they like to write everything down, although they don't let you see it unless you go find it. But the DOD's own directive on non-lethal weapons states that non-lethal weapons shall not, quote, not have 100%, zero capability of producing lethality. In other words, it's possible that you might die, but that's written in there. So we can stop that. We can also look in terms of our local police apparatus. In New York City, for instance, the NYPD has a contract which trains NYPD. Firearms Training Systems Incorporated has a contract with the NYPD. They also train Firearms Training Systems Incorporated, based in Georgia. They train the Marines. They train Special Forces. They use video simulation, virtual, quick shoot reflex, operant conditioning type training. This is an outfit that trains the military and trains the NYPD. There should be citizens who will intervene into these places and say, look, this is not right. We're training police to, kill an innocent civilian and shoot him 41 times. And you wonder why this is taking place and what's up with the training. Well, the same outfit that trains NYPD trains the Marines. These issues have to be looked at. We need to stop the repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act. We need to look very closely at the coming deliberations around this Office of Homeland Security and what it represents. But keep in mind that there's a counterinsurgency apparatus. I'm not one that sees these things in some sort of abstract way. The corporate bosses, if I can sound sort of, throw a little rhetoric at you here, these corporate bosses and so on, they see the handwriting on the wall in terms of global resource availability. They're making their move. It's an insanity, an unprecedented insanity that the Bushites are foisting upon us. That requires a level of repression at home, because they know we won't sit still for it. So what we're seeing now is within this Homeland Security apparatus, and I can go into great detail about this, is the civil disturbance suppression aspect of it, derived from a kind of a generalization of their garden plot, what is called Operation Garden Plot Operation, which, I can get you more information. So get me a way to contact you if you don't have the $10 for the book or whatever we're charging for it, and I will send you, this information as well, and we can all begin to work together on these issues. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Frank and Paul, also in absentia, Matt Illing, the filmmaker. My name is Bill Brown, and I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage here in that I was not included in the film. Indeed, the subject that I'm very interested in, video surveillance of public places, was only mentioned once in the film. But just to remind you of that mention, because I thought it was very interesting, which was that the video surveillance that took place in Seattle was not conducted by the police, but was conducted by Delta Force and DOD, Department of Defense. And that's very interesting when you look at how the police tried to identify protesters after Seattle. They didn't apparently have surveillance cameras in Seattle. The pictures that appeared on the police's websites were taken from handheld video cameras and so forth, indicating that Seattle is undeveloped, as it were, in surveillance. You should understand surveillance cameras as being part of the larger technological transfer that's taken place from the United States military to the private sector. We saw in the film armored personnel carriers and helicopters. Surveillance cameras are also very much part of the military apparatus. And they also begin to make their way into civilian society at approximately the same time, which is approximately 1965 to 1970. This is a very brief summary of surveillance that is public surveillance. The device called closed circuit television, or CCTV as the Brits refer to it, is invented both in the United States and Nazi Germany at the end of the 1930s. It's first used in public places for the purposes of law enforcement by the British in 1960, typically in remote areas where property must be watched 24 hours a day. It is used experimentally here in New York City between 1965 and 1970. And in 22 months of operation, the surveillance cameras in Times Square, which was the test location, netted only 10 arrests for crimes that we would now call quality of life violations, and the cameras were quickly deemed not to be cost effective and were taken down. So that in 1998, when then Mayor Giuliani and then Police Commissioner Howard Safier rigged Washington Square Park with 11 military-styled surveillance cameras, and when you leave Judson Church, look up and to your right, and you will see a military-style surveillance camera looking at you. When those cameras were installed in January of 1998, they reversed a nearly 30-year-old policy. The cameras that you will see if you exit this building do not look like surveillance cameras because they were designed to be intentionally confused with lights, ornaments, and other fixtures. They are globe-shaped devices in which a very small camera can revolve 360 degrees around or pan under its own aperture, so that you should see Washington Square Park as a model of what a militarization of civilian society looks like. There are no signs on these cameras, but the police are obviously there because there's a van that has been parked there continuously for over 4 years, and they're inside watching on antiquated equipment, even though the cameras are digital and very, very sharp. The use of cameras is a sort of a micrological example of what we're talking about. In typical law enforcement, surveillance is something done when you've identified a criminal suspect, you have probable cause, and you have a warrant that assigns covert surveillance on a person for a certain period of time. It is designed to produce small amounts of high-grade information called evidence, and it needs very little treatment. It can be given right to a judge or a jury. But what you find going on outside in Washington Square Park is not law, is not surveillance in the traditional domestic civilian sense, but they are simply watching absolutely everybody. There is nobody suspected of a crime. There is no warrant. There is no probable cause. And there is no sunset provision. It is continuous, indiscriminate, and indefinite. And typical of military-style surveillance, they are assembling vast quantities of low-grade information. And that requires them to have machines or experts that go through thousands of hours of video footage to find something worthwhile. And in that way, you can see very quickly that there is indeed an incompatibility between military styles of surveillance and the court of laws in the United States. A court cannot be dumped huge quantities of low-grade information, but that's what police surveillance cameras are picking up. The things that my group does to counter this sort of very quiet, we see traumatic events, special occasions, riots, the sort of surveillance that you see outside in Washington Square Park is uneventful. It is operating no matter whether there's a riot or a protest or not. And the things that my group, the surveillance camera players, do to fight it is to expose its existence because it seems that it hates secrecy. Or rather, I'm sorry, it hates democracy. And what it prizes is secrecy. So my group performs directly in front of the cameras. We travel about various cities, both in the United States and in the world, and show the cameras to people, especially the globe cameras, which are usually unidentified. We maintain a website at notbored.org, and most importantly, give walking tours based on maps. I have a few maps with me, and I'm happy to give them out. You will be absolutely astonished when you see the concentration of surveillance cameras in Washington Square Park and Greenwich Village, not known to be a high crime area. To bring these remarks to a close, I'd like to give information that I've been dying to give people, which is the fact that the NYPD, in a very interesting way, has completely backed off from my group and the walking tours. Now, when this group began 6 years ago, we were stopped every single time we appeared in public. And since 1999, they've left us alone, and they've been replaced by the United States military. I keep track of visitors to my website, and those of you who are interested in how this works, I can explain. But my site is visited between 2 and 20 times a day by the U.S. military. An astonishing amount. So it's built up to thousands of visits since I've been keeping track. And I've even had to become a kind of indexer to find out there are foreign military agencies visiting, the standard array of U.S. law enforcement agencies, including the Secret Service, NSA, CIA, FBI, and the Mid-State Organized Crime Information Center, a variety of civilian agencies, but especially NASA, which seems to be newly tasked with domestic law enforcement and watching out for dissidents, various police departments at Yale University, the University of Pennsylvania, which Frank mentioned, which is an extraordinary laboratory for surveillance, and the United States military, so many of them that they need their own little sub-list. So these are the people then in DOD who are tasked with spying on us. The communications squadrons in the Air Force. Any subscriber to the non-secure Internet Protocol Router Net, or NIPR, and those include some really heavy hitters, the Pentagon, Army Forces Command, Army Intelligence and Security Center, and the especially Defense Information Systems Agency, my personal friends. Army Signal Command, both in Arizona and all over the world, especially Germany. The United States Marine Corps Network Operations Center in Quantico, Virginia. Quantico being a name that alarms most of us if you catch the reference. And finally, the Naval Air Warfare Center in Patuxent River in Maryland, whose servers are named after characters in The Simpsons. There are 5 servers named Milhouse, Otto, and so forth. So their attitude towards the surveillance is as if this is something easily understandable by The Simpsons or something really not as threatening as I perceive it to be. I will close by reading an answer to a Freedom of Information Act request that I directed to the Defense Information Systems Agency, which has visited 100 times. And I gave them the times and dates and server names of all their visits to let them know that they couldn't lie to me. And it took two letters to get the following. We acknowledge that your website has been visited by at least one of our employees. Apparently, this visit impacted the performance cache flow proxy server. We use the server to maintain control over internet connectivity. It serves as an intermediary device between our employees using the internet and the other web servers. We believe the multiple hits, 100 hits, we believe the multiple hits to your web page may have been caused by our cache server routinely updating itself. Please be assured that no one within Defense Information Systems Agency is monitoring you or your website.
Oh, it makes me feel warm all over hearing that.
I have two comments about the film, as weird as this is now. And I realize the filmmaker is not here, but I'd like to say them anyway. The first comment I have to make is that, again, based on the film and, you know, how the film laid out, it seemed like the cops were only bad when they were in guerrilla mode. And I think we know from our experience of living in the city that the cops are capable of being bad when they're on their kind of in civilian community policing mode. So just kind of like to remind everyone that police brutality doesn't need extra padding. The second thing I'd like to say is, and I'm actually quite upset about this, as an anarchist, and there are other anarchists in the room, I'm absolutely infuriated by the vilification of the Revolutionary Black Bloc in this film. It just makes me screaming mad. Talk about, you know, kind of counterinsurgent propaganda. I find that really reprehensible.
I think it's very important in having a film about the power of the state, especially now after September 11th and the Patriot Act, and especially if you're at all familiar, I mean, the film, they had a documentary on the Discovery Channel called Warrior 2005, something like that, and they outfitted this guy with all, you know, they have them strapped now with sensors that can tell body heat, and they made this all seem so powerful, and I think that anybody who's familiar with this, anybody who watches this film, and anybody who sees them out on the street, one real question comes up that I would like to raise is this question about what's principle here. Is technology principle or a people principle? And I think that the ability of the people to overcome and to take on this stuff is very important. That people invented everything and people can combat everything. You know, there used to be a slogan in the 60s, Huey Newton said it, it's the power of the people is greater, the spirit of the people is greater than the man's technology. And I think it's very important, and I think it's a responsibility of the people on the platform and in that film to raise that question at every time this film is shown. So that question gets debated in the audience, among our ranks, and out in the streets, this question about what's principle. Because if we get intimidated and fearful by this, then we're not going to be able to overcome them and stop them. They're getting ready to go into Iraq, you know, and everything else that we know is going on. And I think this question about what's principle is a fundamental question in our movement, because especially as millions of more people come into the streets, if they're serious about what we're doing, we have to be serious about going up against them. And this question will keep coming back to us in many, many ways. Thank you.
Forgive me for cutting in. I didn't realize that we were not actually going to respond to questions. I must answer the objection from the audience. Your concerns are shared by some of the panelists. I'm sorry, I don't know the woman's name. I had originally seen this trailer when Matt and I collaborated at a discussion at Columbia University. When I saw this trailer sent to me last week, I saw the film sent to me last week. I nearly canceled my appearance here because I agree that the portrait that is given of the anarchists or the revolutionary Black Bloc in Seattle is almost indistinguishable from mainstream coverage. And I decided, after some difficult reflection, that it was important to put aside some of those differences to speak to other people about these issues. But I believe that your objection is very well founded, and that there are other documentaries about Seattle that don't make a position between good protesters and bad protesters, which is what the film perhaps inadvertently but certainly accomplishes. So I want to say I appreciate the comment and didn't realize that other questions would come and go, so that it might have looked like your question was raised and ignored, and I didn't want it to come across that way.
I wanted to begin by addressing the very same issue. I think the film has some difficulty in that all kinds of pieces of that film, many people may have a slightly different view about Gonzalez, and so you never know who you're going to win and lose as you go through the film. The thing I was much more interested in addressing, though, was the technology piece. I have much less worry about being surveilled. I believe that it would be great if everybody in the world was surveilled and everybody watched their surveillance. I think that eventually what would be great would be to have people who are being assassinated by troops all over Africa, being able to have that shown, having protesters, for example, in Seattle, have that police behavior shown all over the world, so that what you have is the same thing that ended the civil rights problem to some degree. It didn't end it. I take that back instantaneously. But the thing that at least began the civil rights movement in a fuller domain was the hosing of blacks on a bridge. And so the more you see of what the world is about, the better off we may be. And I think the important thing is for people to see that technology as something they should be taking over, as opposed to saying that technology is automatically bad.
Again, I see this as an opportunity to talk. This objection has been raised before, and I would have two answers. One is that video evidence did not help Rodney King whatsoever, and that his attackers were acquitted despite shooting back. And the second one is to perhaps suggest the deeper objection I have is to an analogy between guns and cameras. They share a similar vocabulary of shooting, in the same way that I think arming the public to defend themselves against cops with guns is a doomed strategy. Giving everybody cameras so we can shoot back against the police with cameras is also a doomed strategy. We want no guns for police, no cameras for police, not somehow an equalization of forces, because they will always beat us.
Excuse me. Hello?
Could I ask a question? I saw the senator from New York on TV. He mentioned that besides video surveillance, what he is apparently is objecting to in some forum or something is audio surveillance of public spaces, which I want to know if you know anything about audio surveillance and whether they're able to pick up conversations of people walking across the mall in Washington, D.C., etc.
I think the video was pretty good because it shows people the reality about this system. The system of repression, exploitation, oppression on people. It's a system that somehow, that is nature. They are exploiting thousands of people all over the world. The big transnational companies are exploring all Latin America, Africa, all Asia. And because of that, they gotta have the strongest army in the world. They gotta have boats with hundreds of planes. So that way, if people raise up against this oppression, against this system, they can send 100 planes and kill innocent people anywhere they want to. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of this system. You know, I think the video was pretty good because it shows people that here there is no freedom. And that the freedom that the United States is always saying that they are fighting for, those freedoms don't exist. And I think that us, the people of continent, we got opposed to this war. And everybody that we know got opposed to this war. Because we don't want any more war in which the U.S. is going to attack anywhere they want to and whatever they want to. We really need a big transformation in this society. That's the only solution that could really bring peace and a different order all over the world. At least give humanity a chance to fight for a different future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. I think a lot of it is, what was being documented in this movie was that essentially a lot of what has been being done overseas into the more impoverished communities, even within this country, is something that's now coming across. And as we're seeing the erosion of the middle class is basically becoming the lower class and part of the third world. What was very significant about WTO, and what I really liked in this movie, was that in their portrayal of the WTO, was that they showed a full-on attack of what is the most densely populated area of the United States on the West Coast, north of San Francisco. They didn't go after just demonstrators. They went after residents. If you want to see a lot of sort of the motor that's driving it, I recommend that people take a look at the book The Coming Anarchy by Robert Kaplan, or if you can, take a look at the article that came out by that same name in The Atlantic back in 1993, because it's one of those documents that, again, Frank was referring to and I've referred to in my own writing, that's put together by the planners. And a lot of this, as you start to read it, is stuff that's already starting to come true. But he's talking about acknowledging that as the ecological base of our country is getting trashed, the economy gets trashed. As the economy gets trashed, well, if you had rationalists, you'd start thinking about repairing the system. But you don't have rationalists in charge. So what the book starts talking about is ways that those people in charge of everything can continue to hold on to their positions in top of power as the system goes down the tubes. And that's a lot of the motor that's driving it. They're talking in there about increasing things like private security. Take a look. I don't know if the Mayday people in the back have this book, but the book Private Warriors, I think it's Private Warriors by Silverstein, goes into the way that mercenaries are starting to take over the role of a lot of these police, so that we'll have even less accountability. And Africa has pretty much been the blueprint for this. I can't speak for Matt, and I would like to get his opinion on it, but I do think there's some questions about the larger black bloc that should also be raised as well, and probably in a more full discussion on this. You know, personally, I would have loved to have, I thought it would have been really a lot tactically smarter during the WTO if the black bloc, if they were serious about tearing down society, would have gone into Redmond when there were no police there, you know, Microsoft land, as opposed to smashing windows of the local Starbucks and causing $5,000 of damage. But that's just my thought on that.
I have two points. Wondering what your reaction is to the book Blowback by Chalmers Johnson. And the second point is, every day we are losing more of our freedom. At least we can meet here tonight without threat of death. So we still have some freedom.
Well, it's because most of us are white.
Right, but how can we gain back our freedom?
How do we gain? Do you want to address that in 5 words or less?
Well, I think from the specific, I think we need to prevent, the implementation of the Patriot Act through, selected and targeted legal approaches. I think we need to prevent the codification of this Office of Homeland Security, prevent the repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act, blunt the sort of the leading edge of this domestic militarism. But I think, you know, in answer to your question, in real terms, we need as a citizenry to break the hold of the military on our collective throats. When you link profit-making to militarism, you've created a deadly dynamic. From my perspective, a pathology. I think we could most aptly refer to the state at this period as a provocateur state, as a state that picks fights in order to maintain its machinery, its functioning. We know in selected contexts where arms industries, some U.S.-based armed industries, are giving weapons to both sides. This is a deep pathology, militarism, that we're up against. And the one thing I would say, which I've mentioned to some of the activists who are out there in the streets these days, because I've been around for a while, and in the 60s, people were about stopping the war machine. And, you know, other than some of the more, you know, sophisticated political organizations, there was a very shallow corporate critique on the part of the masses of young people that were out. It was about peace and stopping the war machine and demonstrations at the Pentagon and so forth. Whereas today, the critique of corporate capitalism is somewhat sophisticated and deep. But from my perspective, and having looked at this Pentagon, the developments, in, particularly in terms of these operations other than war, and the militarization of the police issue and so forth, the linkages are not being made. And I think we need to come back to the notion of the military-industrial complex. Globalism requires global police. The suits can't do it. So we really need, as in terms of a long-term strategy and getting out from being the slaves of the Pentagon Incorporated, is to really take hold as a people of the apparatus of the Pentagon. Whether that means, you know, we need to target selective, you know, campaigns and ways in which we can go about doing that. We need to bring a million people to the Pentagon the next time July 4th rolls around, because that last revolution was about the placing of troops and the sort of the abuse of militarism. And I think we need to renew that spirit. But, you know, in the short run, I think we really need to roll back some of the more sort of heinous aspects of Ashcroft and company and this domestic repression through, you know, getting out the information about it. And, you know, I peeped this bill, House Representatives 5005, it passed the House. And it's being debated in the Senate right now. We can stop that. We can stop the repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act. Because don't forget, once that takes place, we didn't mention it tonight, but there are two American citizens that are currently in military brigs. This is not the, you know, 1,100 roughly so-called non-citizens who were detained. There are two American citizens who are currently in military brigs being held as part of this military tribunal apparatus, and I didn't go into it here tonight, but, you know, you can't have a lawyer, you can't, be, you know what I mean? It's totally obscene, you know, what's taking place, and there isn't that much of an outcry. If Posse Comitatus is repealed and some of these other aspects in the Office of Homeland Security allowed to go down, we're going to see the shifting of jurisdiction in terms of political crimes, where civil disobedience that took place in Seattle, when you're arrested, it's not, the crime is not so-and-so. The crime becomes subject to military court, because the whole thing about terrorism is linked to it. Don't forget, the preparation for Seattle on the part of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which I go into in here, and the Department of Defense, was all, you know, the apparatus itself was set in motion, all based on the potential terrorist threat. Waco, you know, that's as far-fetched as Waco being a drug operation, but that Waco was bureaucratically a drug operation. There were no drugs there. So, you know, there's a lot of roads that we can go at this thing, but, you know, I think we really need to just reawaken ourselves to a spirit of anti-militarism.
And I would add the thing that I feel that a lot of us need to be doing, the way that one of the reasons that those of us who see some of what's going wrong keep getting creamed is we're just reacting to the latest thing that they're pulling up. Now, some of the documents and some of the reports that we've been referencing here are things that have been written years ago. You, for example, you go to the website www.rand.org, and you will see the plans and terrorism on the terrorism bill that they've been writing for years. This is stuff that's been in the works for years. And a lot of this stuff has not gone to pass yet, but you can bet that they're planning this. So rather than killing the stuff after it starts getting close to getting in place, you kill it as early as it can. You start bringing up the fact that they're talking about this as early as it can. You start reading the reports about these different groups, and yet there are local versions of them wherever you live. There are local versions of these laws that are coming out. They're being tried in the more out-of-the-way areas, in the more rural areas. They're things that people should be familiarizing themselves with. People should be using the open meetings and public records law. Every activist should be using that on a daily basis. And they should not just be going to the meetings that you hear about. You should start digging this stuff up and seeing what are the things that, for example, your city council may be passing in Portland, the termless consent agenda, that three-quarters of the things that they voted on were all lumped together under one vote that they did. Do you all vote for the consent agenda? Yes. Well, I found out that if you actually looked at the way the city's charter was written, you could have debate on any one of those issues. So you'd pull them out and you'd start getting people talking about them. And killed a lot of programs just by bringing those into the public eye. So start, honing ourselves as researchers. That's one of the things we can do, because getting the stuff before it gets put in place.
This electromagnetic weapon, and I don't like to fetishize these things and make everyone, the whole paranoia thing, because it's not about that. It can be stopped. University of Pennsylvania, people got a hold of that institute and got in there. But in terms of that particular weapon, it was being field tested in Massachusetts, and I know that there's a bill, I don't know if it's still being debated or what have you, but this is some time ago, that was put up in the Massachusetts state legislature to ban that weapon while they were field testing it. So, if this is groups got together there and they're moving. So people are moving all over the country. It's a dialectic. That's what I meant about counterinsurgency. What's happening is that, we're struggling. You know what I mean? It's a counterattack. Things are coming to a head. This maniac is threatening war against the entire globe. And, we have our work cut out for us, but, I'm optimistic.
That was journalist and civil liberties advocate Paul Richmond. You've been listening to a panel discussion on the militarization of policing and the repression of political dissent under the guise of a war on terrorism. The discussion took place last month in New York City, following the screening of a documentary film, Urban Warrior. A reminder, Scott Ritter, former UN Chief Weapons Inspector in Iraq, an outspoken critic of the Bush administration's planned invasion, will be speaking at Binghamton University, Tuesday, December 3rd. Ritter's talk, The Coming War with Iraq, How Did We Get Here?, will take place at the Anderson Center Concert Theater at 7 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. That's Tuesday, December 3rd, at Binghamton University. If you're listening to this program on 88.1 FM in Ithaca and you appreciate this service, please consider making a donation to Ithaca Community Radio to help us defray the $10,000 it has cost to put this transmitter online. For more information on how to donate, visit the Ithaca Community Radio website at www.ithacaradio.org.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.